Hey everyone, if you have been listening to Empire, you know that Santi and I are fed up with unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds that make the on-chain experience basically unusable. So the Arbitrum team reached out and they showed us the platform. They showed us what you can do on Arbitrum. Whatever you're doing, you can experience frictionless transactions at lightning speed on Arbitrum. So head over to portal.arbitrum.io and check it out. This episode is brought to you by Monad, which has not only the highest performance EVM L1 architecture ever built, but also the wildest and craziest community in crypto. Monad's internal devnet is live and public testnet comes out soon. So make sure you join the Monad community today at discord.gg/Monad, M-O-N-A-D, Monad. Tired of high gas fees? I'm excited to let you know about our newest sponsor, Scale, a zero gas fee modular blockchain that's become a perfect fit for both gaming and AI apps because of their instant finality and lack of MEV. Bridge to Scale today via their portal. It's portal.scale.space and follow their journey on X at Scale Network. You'll hear more about Scale later in the show. All right, everyone, welcome back to another episode of Empire. Very excited for this one. We've got a special, I would call it a Bitcoin L2 podcast, but it's not actually going to be, as you will find out, a Bitcoin L2 show, but really just talking with Matt and Amin, the CEO and CTO and the two co-founders of Arch. Many of you might know them, many of you might not know them, and we're here to both share the story, but also talk about what's happening on Bitcoin right now. Matt, I think I'd pick on you to, like, at least personally, I need some context. Because I've seen, at least in the private markets, just this explosion of funding and activity happening on Bitcoin. It feels like DeFi is finally coming to Bitcoin, lending and borrowing is happening on Bitcoin, and there's this explosion, and I don't fully understand it. So I'm going to pick on you to kind of tee up, like, how did we get here, and what's maybe what happened with the Taproot upgrade in November 2021, and how did that lead into, like, this Cambrian explosion of activity that we're seeing on Bitcoin today?
Yeah, I think that it really represented a watershed moment for Bitcoin because, like you mentioned, the combination of Taproot's enhanced programmability and the data inscription capabilities that are introduced by Ordinals really marked a foundational shift in Bitcoin's evolution. It really signaled the beginning of a new era where Bitcoin could serve as a base layer for more complex protocols, paving the way for innovations like Arch that could seek to harness Bitcoin's inherent security and, most importantly, the liquidity for a broader range of applications. So that's ultimately what Arch set out to do, which is unlock and extend the capabilities of Bitcoin and bring programmability to the base chain.
Nice. Say more. Like, why was this so important? I don't know if this is a question for Matt or for Amin, but, like, what was it about Taproot that was so important for Bitcoin?
It was significant because for the first time ever, you could put arbitrary data on Bitcoin, right? And that's important for the modular stack and creating the potential for native programmability via smart contract and execution. So that was what initially made it possible. And so for all the people out there that are wondering, you know, Bitcoin's been around forever. It's never been possible before. Why is this happening now? Why is everybody, like, all of a sudden interested in building on Bitcoin now? And that's the answer, right? Is Ordinals and the Taproot upgrade really made that possible and paved the way for builders to come in and take advantage of Bitcoin's absolute security and liquidity that is, best in class.
Okay, so we get Taproot, right? We get this upgrade in November 2021. It gives us programmability on Bitcoin, and then after Taproot, this thing called Ordinal starts happening, right? So walk us through, like, what happened here as kind of the first foray into, like, building things on Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think, like, early last year, it was very exciting to see. You had a bunch of different programmers, builders, all excited with this newfound, capability of putting data on Bitcoin. And at first you saw everyone inscribing JPEGs, audio files, And that whole Ordinal movement really took on, which was a phenomenal thing to see. And I think that that was, an elegant proof of concept. But we're heading into the most exciting piece now, where it's a watershed moment for Bitcoin, where you'll see developers and builders actually building intuitive applications like you've seen over the last 6 years on Ethereum. And I think it's an incredibly bullish situation for Bitcoiners altogether.
I saw on that Notion page, you had this like, all right, so you've got Taproot plus Ordinals equals like foundational shift, basically. What is this, as you guys call it, like what is the foundational shift?
Yeah, I mean, you want to take this one?
Yeah, so Ordinals became huge. A lot of developers came from Ethereum and Solana, and they saw the potential of being able to store data on Bitcoin and do more stuff than just payments. And I think this is what propelled people to start building on top of Bitcoin instead of just going for all the other chains.
Yeah, can we go maybe a little bit more specific into Arc itself and canvassing? You know, as Yana alluded to, there's been sort of an explosion of let's build an L2 on Bitcoin. I have my reservations on that, and that's how I got to know you guys, because I think you guys are quite different in that approach. So let's maybe just start venturing into how you guys are approaching this and how you see the kind of the current landscape evolving.
Yeah, I think like our you know, when we were, Amin and I really came up with the idea for Arch, we were, you know, grinding every single day around Thanksgiving in the Bitcoin Startup Lab. Day and night, we were interviewing developers, various customer interviews, interviewing other builders in the space that were all in one form or another trying to address some type of a native application or protocol that they wanted to bring to Bitcoin, take advantage of this, you know, giant movement. But in interviewing all of these people, we realized that they were all trying to figure out which L2 they wanted to build on. And that was kind of our aha moment for Amin and I, as we said, why is everybody giving up on Bitcoin? Why is everyone like going down to the layer two in order to achieve this native programmability or, you know, native? Air quotes for the listeners at home. But you know, we realized that this has already played out on Ethereum. There's, you know, many different L2s in the Ethereum ecosystem that offer different things like scalability, speed, low fees, but the majority of the liquidity is going to stay on the layer one network, where you aren't sacrificing or trading off in your trust assumptions and security principles. And we think we feel pretty strongly about this, that Bitcoin is going to be the same way. Like, you're going to have the majority of the liquidity sitting in the on the base chain, where you have more principled features and security. And we realize that even Bitcoiners are even more so this way, where they care about their sovereignty, they care about keeping ownership of their keys and not necessarily, you know, bridging their assets to a completely different chain. So that's what we set out to do. We created a novel solution to bring native programmability to basically foster Bitcoin native applications, as opposed to bridging those assets down to a layer two or a layer three, for that matter, which are seem to come about nowadays. You don't have to give up on Bitcoin. You can achieve that programmability on Bitcoin without. I mean, now that this Taproot and Ordinals upgrade are available to foster this level of innovation.
The first, as I'm hearing this, it makes a lot of sense. The first question that comes to my mind, or two, are concerns, I'd say, are scalability and cost. Whenever you're trying to do something natively in the L1, at least in Ethereum, the challenge has been, to your point, scalability and cost. So is that an issue for your approach? And if so, kind of how do you mitigate that or work around that?
I'd say that we're still definitely confined to limitations of Bitcoin in block size and block times. But we were extremely explicit in the trade-offs that we were making when addressing the design principles of Arch. And the main trade-off is we're willing to deal with the block fees and block times in order to not give up the security principles and sovereignty of the user's coins and keys. These other L2s, they may focus on scalability and low fees, but they certainly are trading off more of the principled security that is more accustomed and accepted by native Bitcoin users.
I just have one question about, like, so you are basically saying we're fine with these like long transaction times, and the reason we're fine with that is because we don't want to compromise on the security. How does this like impact actually how the ecosystem develops, like DeFi and all these kind of things. Like if I was playing on Solana or playing on like a Arbitrum or Optimism or an L2, like I would not be okay with like hour long wait times or whatever, 30 minute wait times. But maybe your vision is like, okay, well, our ecosystem is just going to develop very differently than Solana, but maybe you could paint a picture of what you envision this looking like.
I think like for Bitcoin, the main use case for DeFi is high volume transactions. People that are not willing to make the trade-off of bridging and trading off security. And also luxury JPEGs, which we've seen like just have this massive boom on with Ordinals.
Yeah, also I would say that, you know, our design is massively inspired by the Solana VM. We store states independently inside of UTXO so that we can run them in parallel, which actually increases its efficiency for processing transactions and execution. If we did this the EVM way, it would be much slower and much more inefficient. So we were very intentional in the way that we created our design to create for this efficiency. But that being said, 10-minute block times are a reality of Bitcoin. So in order to do native Bitcoin transactions, you have to submit to the mempool and actually be included into the block. And that takes 10 minutes. And that's until a soft fork happens into Bitcoin. That's nothing. We can't do anything about that. But that was an intentional design choice by Bitcoin back in the day to really prioritize security over speed of execution. So I would say that we're right there in the middle of it. You know, I don't think that these faster transactions on the L2s are necessarily worthy of bridging your assets at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I go back to, you know, most L2s remind me of just, you know, either Badger or like Wrap Bitcoin. Like you could, if you're a Bitcoiner and you were willing to accept these security trade-offs, you would have bridged over to Ethereum DeFi and started playing around there. And a lot of the current L2 designs on Bitcoin kind of are that. So I'm a bit not very impressed. And I passed on most of those rounds because it's like, well, why is this different? And it's like, it's not. Let's go back to Yano's question around like DeFi, for instance, in how you're... You know, what kind of applications do you think are really going to thrive in your ecosystem? You know, when you think about, as Yano alluded to, payments or, you know, DeFi, fast settlement times are pretty critical. Like composability is a thing that keeps coming over and over again. So do you have a view there? What kind of applications or developers are really interested in building on the network?
Yeah, we have... about 20 different projects who are currently building on Arch and on top of Bitcoin, mostly DeFi and things of that nature. Some have come from other chains like Ethereum and Solana to come build. But before we unpack that, actually, I'd like to go back to the previous point real quick that we're talking about these EVM L2s. And, mm-hmm. and Amin's got some great insight into why these developers are actually choosing to go this route and why we think that this is not the way to go.
Yeah. I think most of the developers just came straight from ETH with all their baggage and just started making the same stuff that already existed on Ethereum. So since Ethereum already had programmability, they just started making L2s on Bitcoin, which we think isn't the good way to do it. You need to wait and see what Bitcoin has and what it lacks. So you can make the best execution layer for it, which is what we're making.
Yeah, I would say in addition to that you know, there's a lot of different design choices that these massive amounts of layer twos that are coming into the picture are choosing. Some of them more EVM copy paste, some of them more novel in design, like Stax, for example, and. At the end of the day, what we want to see for Bitcoin in the long term is continued development innovation directly into it, right? We don't want to see this activity being traversed away from Bitcoin. And more importantly, we don't want to see the EVM taking the majority of the activity and fees that otherwise the miners could be generating, which ultimately is securing the blockchain for the long haul, right? As the halvening are these built-in mechanisms to try to get us as a community, or as a developer community, I should say, more specifically, to create these types of innovations that can secure the network for the long haul. And I think that that's what we're mainly addressing, is we want to keep as much of the activity for DeFi and other consumer applications on Bitcoin itself, so that not only it secures the future of Bitcoin and crypto as a whole, but also continues to allow native Bitcoin users to tap into, you know, secure yield opportunities, which is what they want to do. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this every day. You can look at applications like Liquidium, who is, you know, doing borrowing and lending against ordinals on Bitcoin's layer one. And they're growing at a phenomenal pace, because this is an accepted thing that now Bitcoiners want to engage in. They want native yield for their assets.
I want to, that's a good point. I want to double click on what you just said, which is you're inspired by the SVM design and parallelization. And of course the EVM is a single threaded. And how does that play into the security? When you think about parallelization, but also the constraint of like execution of the L1, like how do you introduce that into like natively? I would assume that there's some security, like you are making a minor trade-off. Maybe it's not as much as an L2, but I am curious if you're free to push back on that. I'm just trying to understand how that fits into like natively into the L1.
Yeah, so the way Arch works is we store states inside UTXOs. So for non-overlapping states, you can basically run transactions in parallel instead of doing it the EVM way. If we did it that way, we'll do like one transaction per block and then need to wait for it to confirm to process other transactions, which would be like a very bad user experience. Imagine waiting 10 minutes just for someone else to process another transaction on a DEX. But yeah, we do store states inside UTXOs, which gives us this ability without even trading off anything.
And let's, I guess, maybe talk a little bit more, Amin, about the actual architecture of Arch and how the VM and the verifier network ultimately plays into this execution and state change.
Yeah, for sure. So Arch starts with invocation transaction which contains all the relevant information for execution. The last state, you can pass PSBT, some other smart contracts call info, and then you go ahead and run the execution inside the ZKVM. The smart contract needs to output an unsigned transaction which reflects the asset change that happened during execution. The resulting states, which reflect the state change that happened during execution, as well as a proof for that execution. And then everything is then sent to a verifier network, which basically runs a proof of stake mechanism using thresholded signature schemes, where each node in the verifier network votes on the validity of the proof before sending the transaction to Bitcoin.
I see. So there you are trusting this verified network that is sufficiently decentralized, distributed. So as a skeptical Bitcoiner, that is, you know, let's just assume that that's your market. They would probably be most interested in understanding how is this verified network composed of, who's actually running it. Because if that were to break, and maybe we can talk about scenarios where that may or may not, then you might have an issue, right?
Yeah, the set of trust assumptions we picked is actually very interesting. It makes it so that the makers who are providing liquidity take on additional trust assumptions, but the takers don't. So let's take, for example, an AMM, a DEX. The people who will be providing liquidity inside the liquidity pools would be taking additional trust assumptions and sending their Bitcoin to this smart contract controlled wallet. But the takers of that liquidity will be taking that liquidity in one transaction. Transaction would be atomic, so they wouldn't be taking any additional trust assumptions. And that doesn't happen on any L2. You need to bridge to the L2 to use like anything.
And from a maker perspective, So in the scenario you just described, so I'm providing liquidity to an AMM that is built on an Arc. What is the most important thing there? Like, what would be the worst case scenario for a liquidity provider in this case?
Yeah, so to participate in the Verify network, you need to put up stake. And anyone who has done anything considered malicious gets slashed in the stake. Yeah. So as long as what you're putting in is below what's staked inside the network, you're good. There is no reason for the participator in the network to steal your funds. Mm-hmm.
This might be a really stupid question, but what is the requirement to participate in the validator network, like on the verifier network? Is that just you're just a liquidity provider by default? You're staking, but who's like doing the verification, and what are perhaps the requirements to do that?
Yeah, so to participate in the verifier network, you need to put up stake, of course, and then run an Arch node.
Run a what? Sorry,
so, Arch node.
Okay. And what are the, who would be doing that?
Yeah. So, while we're bootstrapping the network, we're limiting it to a set of trusted people, our network partners, people who have stake in the protocol as it launches. But after that, as the network is bootstrapped, we'll make it open and permissionless. So anyone can run an Arch node.
We're also working with quite a few commercial validators as well. That are interested in participating in the verifier network.
Yeah, got it. And so this would that is perhaps the, when you think about maybe a Bitcoiner saying, wait a minute, but like I really want to understand who these folks are from a censorship resistance perspective, which, you know, that's been the biggest criticism. If you talk to a Bitcoin Max, you'd be like, why look at Ethereum, proof of stake generally, like most of these nodes are in jurisdictions where censorship resistance can be an issue. Is this perhaps going to be an issue or just a concern for a subset of the Bitcoiners that have been historically critical of just Ethereum and its current architecture?
I don't think so. Like as the network decentralizes and more nodes join the network, it would be fairly decentralized to secure the whole stake that's inside Arch, the whole liquidity that's inside Arch.
Yeah. So you plan, just give us a sense of just how you envision this sequence. Initially, you'll have a curated list of a validator, so to speak, and then like, what would you need to see to get comfortable to open it up to other people?
Yeah, we just need to see more people participate in the network. At first, we're gonna curate people who join the network to not do anything malicious. But as the stake gets big, and overtaking the network gets harder, we'll make it more and more permissionless.
Got it. And so, just to round out this discussion of the architecture, you're still in the L1 for like, just trying to like simplify it for folks. You're still in the L1, but within a particular block, you are using like parallelization, and that allows you to process many, many more transactions within a block. You are kind of offloading some trust assumptions onto a validator network. A lot of that security lays on the liquidity providers, and then a subset of people that are running validation initially, you know, curated by you guys over time. Open it up, and then that should is what you guys are saying, be a much easier or perhaps jump from a security standpoint than an L2 that is currently built, you know, some of the other ones that are being built on, that you have to bridge, you have to trust a lot of their kind of setup and whatnot. I wasn't far off the mark there. Maybe we can start perhaps talking more from a consumer standpoint. How you, a lot of folks, when they may be hearing this, would be like, well, how is this going to be any different? Like, look at Ethereum. People have just accepted some L2s, some which don't even have fraud proofs, which are just basically multisigs. And, you know, people time and time again in crypto have I guess, put security on the back seat and just chase yield, do some of these things. It matters how much is at stake. It matters perhaps the type of application, right? If you're doing gaming versus, you know, a high value DeFi transaction. Who, from a consumer standpoint, like how would interacting in your network contrast to maybe some of the 10 other Bitcoin L2s that are cropping up in terms of fees, in terms of speed, in terms of variety of applications? I know it's a difficult question, but I'm just kind of curious if you have a view there.
Yeah, I think I'll take this one. I think that first and foremost, we're not here to say that, you know, the L2 world is not going to exist. If Flatl won't exist, we think there are some use cases that may be fair to some L2s, and it's still going to be, you know, a couple hundred billion dollar opportunity. But by comparison to all the liquidity that's sitting on the layer one network, it pales in comparison, right? And the major you know, difference from a user standpoint is that you don't need an additional wallet, or you don't need to bridge those assets in order to participate in DeFi or programmability on Bitcoin, right? That's the first step for all of these L2s, is you first have to bridge. With Arch, you don't need to bridge anything. You simply can sign a Bitcoin transaction on whichever Dapper protocol that's integrated with us or built on top of our VM. And you can sign a Bitcoin transaction through your Xverse, through your Unisat, through your Magic Eden wallet. It doesn't matter. You don't need anything custom. And you can participate. And that's the major differentiator for us, is in addition to builders being able to tap into the 1.3 in today's liquidity that's on Bitcoin. But from a user experience standpoint, it is so much more of a better experience. And if you ask a native user of Liquidium, you know, why they participate in ordinal borrowing and lending on Liquidium versus another project on an L2, it's because they don't want to bridge their expensive and premium assets to these new side chains or layer two chains in order to achieve that yield. It's just something that they don't want to do. But, you know, I think that as we've seen this play out on Ethereum time and time again, there's going to be some liquidity that gets bridged down there to participate in these low fee environments, because it's just not going to make sense to pay $20 in Bitcoin fees for a $10 transaction of a shitcoin or something like
that. Yeah. I'll throw it over to you. Can you comment a little bit on this point, perhaps the fees and the speed of transactions? How might those compare, your network versus another Bitcoin L2?
Yeah, so for Arch, we are confined by the block size and block times. So we can, assuming all transactions in the block are transactions coming from Arch, we can do about 3,000 to 4,000, depending on the block. And for the L2, of course, it's gonna be it's gonna be a 20x roundabout if they actually implement everything right using ZK and stuff. Mm-hmm.
So say that again. So it's be 3,000. Did I hear you? 3,000 to 6,000.
Yeah. 3,000 to 4,000. If all transactions in the block are transactions that are coming from our, since we do parallel execution with independent
space. Right.
If it is the EVM way, it would be one transaction per block, which would be
it would be just incredibly slow and expensive. The one last thing before we just move on, in terms of what is the mechanism for when you're running parallelization, in the Solana, the SVM kind of way, there are different types of parallelization, not to make this a podcast about parallelization itself. It is an interesting topic, I think. How can you just comment on how the parallelize, as I understand it, if you compare Sui, say Aptos, Solana, some of them use deterministic, some of them use probabilistic, I believe. How do you guys, what was your thinking in terms of which one to implement or what type of mechanism to implement? Maybe it's a different one.
Yeah. So all of the chains that you mentioned have an account model in mind, so it's really hard to
different implement. Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's really hard to implement parallelization there, since you still need to access the kind of a global state of how much each account has in Sol or say. But with Bitcoin, we have UTXOs, so there isn't that problem. It's actually, Bitcoin was made in a way that parallelization fits in very well.
Can you, for maybe most listeners may not have appreciated that, but can you go deeper into that?
Just like, so Bitcoin uses the UTXO model, where basically you lock your Bitcoin inside a script that can be only unlocked using like a pub key or like a multi-sig script. So that makes it so a lot of people can lock Bitcoin independently, and all of those transactions can be run in parallel.
Right. Because you're very clearly defining what is spent, what is not unspent. And so that allows you to very quickly order the transactions very efficiently, and then run. So presumably the way you run parallelization, does that make it way more efficient? Just higher throughput relative to traditional parallelization techniques that we've seen in other chains? Is that a fair?
Yeah. Yeah, if you're doing parallelization with the UTXO model, since every UTXO is locked independently, you don't need to go through the global state of accounts, mm-hmm. which makes it like way easier to use.
Right. Okay, that's really interesting.
Also, from a proof standpoint, we do use validity proofs, which is fairly different than what other layer twos rely on. In a more optimistic setup. So maybe Amin can share a little bit about why that matters and also how it plays into the requirements for node operators as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point, man.
Yeah, so a lot of L2s right now are using BitVM, claiming to use BitVM, which is not out yet. BitVM uses fraud proofs, which require this challenge period to settle execution. For the L1 Bitcoin, that's not possible to run smart contract transactions there. Imagine a DEX where people wait for a challenge period to use it. So the only option for us was using validity proofs, and instead of assuming something is correct and waiting for someone to invalidate it, we just prove it's valid, which makes the user experience way better.
It also makes the requirements for the node to run the node much lighter as well.
Yeah, that seems to be a common mid-curve skepticism or criticism, right?
All right, I mentioned them in the pre-roll. Now I'm going to bring them up again. It's Arbitrum. Santi and I are really fed up with these high fees, and we're really excited to have teamed up with Arbitrum for the next couple of months on Empire. As the leading Ethereum scaling solution, Arbitrum now powers hundreds of decentralized apps across DeFi, perps, NFTs, gaming, and a whole lot more. The team has showed us everything in the ecosystem, both now and what's to come, and we're really, really excited about it. Arbitrum allows both daily users and developers to interact with Ethereum at scale with low fees and faster transactions. The way the team got me excited was through portal.arbitrum.io. So my call to action to you is to get started by visiting portal.arbitrum.io. Go experience on-chain like it was meant to be. This episode is brought to you by Monad. Monad's thesis is simple. The EVM is here to stay, similar to JavaScript and Web 2, but unfortunately, today's EVM lacks the high performance and the scalability that developers need to make certain applications possible. Monad addresses these concerns and these bottlenecks while preserving seamless EVM composability for application developers. There's a seamless transition to Monad as the Ethereum RPC API allows for really easy portability. And for developers, Monad can support 10,000 real transactions per second with their unique parallel execution environment. And of course, there's full compatibility with EVM bytecode. Monad's internal DevNet is live. Public testnet comes out soon. You can join Monad's journey in two ways. One, go follow them. They're on Twitter at Monad, MONAD_XYZ. And also join the Monad Discord. It's discord.gg/Monad. Big thanks to Monad for sponsoring Empire. Hey everyone, Jason here. I know you've been hearing a lot about the intersection of crypto and AI, and that's why I'm really excited to share our newest partner and sponsor at Empire, Scale, a high-performance modular blockchain that's revolutionizing gaming and AI. With zero fees and instant finality, Scale's unique architecture allows for massive scalability and has already saved users over $6 billion in gas fees. The five main takeaways that you need to know for Scale. One, zero gas fees. Two, Scale has instant finality and lack of MEV. 3, the zero gas fee model of Scale is really important for blockchain gaming adoption, as gamers don't have to pay transaction costs or have the SKL token. 4, Scale is multi-chain. This design allows for nodes to be combined to create chains and for individual subnodes to actually be removed and relocated, which creates greater security and collusion resistance. And 5, Scale has become a really good fit for AI dApps because they're fast, automated, zero fee transactions. Big thank you to Scale for sponsoring Empire. We're excited to partner with you guys. Bridge over to Scale if you're listening to this via the portal, portal.scale.space, and follow the journey along with Scale on X at Scale Network. That's at Scale Network. Big thanks again to Scale for sponsoring Empire. What, guys, what is the reason why someone would build on Arch? Like, when you're sitting down with a founder, why or what is the pitch here?
The pitch is quite simple. It's, look, there's all this liquidity sitting on layer one looking for something to do with their Bitcoin to find safe and secure yield. Are you going to build somewhere where the liquidity already is? Or are you going to build somewhere where you're going to wait for that liquidity to arrive and then address those users once they come? It is our strong belief and conviction that while the majority of the liquidity is going to remain on the layer one, that gives us a total advantage when speaking to these developers and dApps and protocols who want to tap into that liquidity and bring DeFi in a meaningful way. As I said before, we've seen this play out on Ethereum. We don't feel that much liquidity in comparison to the total amount of Bitcoin liquidity is ultimately going to bridge. And that's where we have that advantage. So we're speaking to, you know, and working with many different dApps and protocols who want to bring these various ideas that are proven concepts on other chains, but now trying to take advantage of the security principles and the liquidity that Bitcoin can offer.
Cool. On this point, because I asked it before, but it wasn't clear in my mind, like we definitely talked about the security assumptions. We talked about like the transaction, you know, speed or throughput on the fee side. Because I think it matters in terms of the type of users and the type of transactions that you might see on the network initially. Do you have a sense of how that, you know, how expensive or not it's going to be to interact in the network?
When you go on Liquidium right now, and I'm just using them as an example, because there's as of this moment, there isn't a lot of DeFi applications on Bitcoin for obvious reasons, right? The only thing that's before Arch that was available for pseudo programmable solutions would be DLCs, discrete log contracts, which effectively require you to predetermine two transaction pathways, two parties, and what the conditions of those transaction pathways ultimately are going to set in, and then you require an oracle to ultimately determine which transaction pathway should be a centralized oracle at that, which transaction pathway will ultimately take effect. But as you see these transactions ultimately play out on Bitcoin, users are technically paying anywhere from like $8 to $15 per transaction in order to participate in this type of programmability. And, you know, we've seen this type of stuff play out on ETH again, where gas fees, can be expensive, but not a detriment to the protocol or the DApp.
Yeah. I have a go-to-market question actually. So you guys have, the benefit of having like, you know, dozens, if not actually probably hundreds of like roll-ups, and you've seen the whole monolithic versus modular thing play out and all these L2s. Like, what are your takeaways in terms of when you look at like the different go-to-market strategies and honestly tech stack strategies that you've seen, you know, over the last, let's call it 3 to 5 years? Like, what do you want to do? Like, what have you learned that you want to kind of lean into, and who have you learned from? And maybe the flip side of that is like, who have you seen maybe not do this in the right way?
Yeah. This has already played out, and monolithic versus like modular, there is different things that you can do for both, different use cases, but I think here the clear winner is the monolithic. Solana's been doing great, and although these L2s had a lot of time to experiment during the last bull markets and bear markets, they haven't achieved the speeds nor the reliability to for mass adoption while Solana has. So I definitely think the winner is Solana. But for app chains and stuff, for specific applications, I think there is a merit for layers.
What's your maybe like, if you guys are successful, I mean, what is the 5-year vision here of Arch, or 10-year? Like, what does this start to look like if you guys are wildly successful with everything?
Yeah, so first of all, I would like to see the pillars of DeFi, like lending and borrowing, liquidity pools on Bitcoin, stablecoin, which there is a team we're working on stablecoin. I think stablecoins is pretty much the biggest crypto use case, and it hasn't been possible on Bitcoin in a decentralized fashion. So yeah, pretty excited about that as well. I would like to see like a DeFi boom on Bitcoin. That would be awesome. Like similar to what happened on Ethereum on 2016, 2017, and leading to the bull markets of 2020.
I think you could draw comparisons to the emergence of the whole Ethereum ecosystem from 2016 all the way to 2020 and today, where you have a whole vibrant ecosystem of dApps and protocols and composability and money Legos, all these that ultimately contributed to the surging value of Ethereum. And you can really draw that back to programmability via smart contracts. That's what made that all possible. So what I think that you're going to ultimately see on Bitcoin is you're going to see at least everything that was once tried and proven on Ethereum and Solana at the very least is going to be tried on Bitcoin. Some will take effect, and maybe not like ticketing dApps and things of that nature will never make sense on Bitcoin. But I think there's a lot of DeFi pillars and protocols that have proven themselves to work and be something that traders want to trade on top of and arb and participate in all these different forms of speculation and decentralized finance. I think you're going to see that on Bitcoin over the next year and a half. And then the sky's the limit. Then you can start to bring various institutional products into light that allows you to leverage the native yield that some of these DeFi protocols ultimately create the possibility for.
So in a scenario where my working assumption is we have a proliferation of L2s on Bitcoin, we may have also proliferation of ordinal activity on the native chain. Just going back to fees, like, we've seen a pretty substantial spike in fees in the Bitcoin network, which candidly, from my standpoint, it's really good. You know, you have to at some point work the security budget for Bitcoin. And exactly. You know, miners are really incentivized. Miners have always had the final say. But how do you think about the viability of your architecture in a world where, you know, transaction fees on the L1 might just really skyrocket, make it prohibitively expensive, where it's only a very narrow subset of users? Is that market large enough? How do you think about, by the way, may not play out exactly as Ethereum, but like Ethereum L1 fees are continue to go up, right? Yeah, of course, you can offload a lot of stuff with modularity, yada, yada, yada. But the reality is L1 is for a very small subset of users that are willing to accept that, right? How do you think about, because while you're running parallelization, you are competing, right, in that block with other folks that might want to do a million other things. How do you think about that?
It's a really good question. I think Amin has something to say about it, but I would say that, you know, block inclusion is going to be a major factor and a major commodity, block space being a major commodity in the next year and a half, as everyone is going to be fighting for that distribution. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. But we are making a lot of considerations for exactly that future, speaking with miners, working with them to make sure that we are included in these blocks versus other chains that are trying to, compress that data and bring it back to Bitcoin. So I think that we're in a good position to address this, but Amin might have some comments.
Yeah. I do think there'll be in the next bull market there'll be a big fight for block inclusion from all the L2s, and also the MEV scene will pick up like quite a lot.
Yeah, especially who's gonna do that on Bitcoin? I'll fund that.
It's gonna get crazy, man. Like we've seen people do private mempools now, and like it's gonna get quite hectic in the next bull market. But that's good. Yeah. That's good for Bitcoin. Like,
that's a good problem. Yeah. Do you ultimately think, I mean, doing upgrades, like the Taproot upgrade was like a Herculean effort. You still have many people in the Bitcoin core kind of just being really skeptical of it and the hate ordinals and whatever. At the end of the day, like the market always wins, I think. But I'm curious, like, do you think that there may be a future where fee markets in Bitcoin, like there's a modification to where you can have, I don't know, like an EIP 50, this might be again stupid analogy, but like an EIP 1559 type of mechanism in Bitcoin. And this is where I'm tipping my hand because I've actually haven't really paid much attention to how fees actually work on Bitcoin. Like you can write private mempools, you can probably pay a higher fee, but I'm curious, like, is there a version where you think that there could be an upgrade to the L1 where fees become, there's just a fee upgrade to make it, you know, to work around this problem?
The only way to make fees cheaper on Bitcoin is to increase the block size, which is a big
good luck with that.
The block wars, that was quite traumatic for a lot of people. Gladly I wasn't there. But yeah, I don't think that would happen, but like anything can happen at the end of the time. We just need to see it play out.
Maybe I'm curious, you guys have been around, you've paid attention to the space for a long time. I think everyone like is salivating over this idea that like there's all this unproductive capital in Bitcoin, still largest network. You know, why wouldn't you build there? Why wouldn't you facilitate more utility? But it is quite hard to build there, I think. But like you guys could be doing a million other things. Why build here? Why, like, did you explore other possibilities? Build your own chain, build on Ethereum, build on Solana. Like, I'm curious, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
I come from extensive backgrounds in chain agnostic, whether building on top of Ethereum, Solana, Bitcoin itself, or investing passively from the sidelines over the last, decade, it feels like. My time in Bitcoin is really dated back to my time in Tallahassee at Florida State, where someone told me that Bitcoin was going to be $100,000 one day. And at the time it was less than 10. So naturally I was incredibly excited to immerse myself in the culture and learn as much as I could, which led me down the rabbit hole of learning to mine in my dorm room and day trade those coins on BitInstant, like a long time ago, if you even remember what BitInstant is. But I think the main reason for us and why we reached this conclusion was like no one else is doing it. Everyone is giving up on Bitcoin, even though we all agree that this radical shift just happened, creating a new possibility. And we knew that this opportunity was going to be absolutely massive because it offered that the functionality that people absolutely desire, And you see this with the programmable dApps and protocols that they're already starting to build on stacks and even Bitcoin today, like with Liquidium, as I keep mentioning. But there just wasn't the picks and shovels available for these builders to actually build what they wanted to build. So we viewed that as just an absolute massive opportunity. And I think that, our investors and advisors would agree from that standpoint. And also just the extraordinary amount of interest that we've been getting from the developer community to want to come and build something on Arch has been extremely encouraging. Incredible amount of interest from people who want to build natively on Bitcoin as opposed to, trading off security principles and putting their users into the position of having to decide that. I think that that's been extremely encouraging. And we knew that this was a massive, massive opportunity so that it was just, there was no interest from us to build anything else.
Yeah. I do want to go back to this thing and I want to make sure I get it right. It is certainly like your setup is more, I guess you give up less on security relative to an L2. You are still making some what you think is a marginal trade-off where you need to get comfortable with this network of participants that are doing the validation as you're running parallel transactions in that block, right?
That's right. Yeah. You, as a market maker or maker in depending on the use case that we're talking about here, you will be engaging in some limited trust assumptions and putting that trust on the network of nodes.
On the network. Yeah.
Yeah.
On that point, and I keep going back to this because I think it's the most important thing, because what is the mechanism for dispute and resolution? And to roll it, like, I don't want to say roll it back, but like in an instance where the, like, I guess you can, you're slashed, but as a user, can you contest that? Can you, like, in an L2, as an example, in an L2 without fraud proofs, it's like, you're gone, right? There's an L2 that has fraud proofs, but has a centralized sequencer. They can ultimately, like, withhold the transaction, they can stall it, but you can always settle it back to the L1. And I think a lot of people have that confusion, right? They criticize, like, the centralized sequencer. I'm like, that's not a security trade-off you're making. That's because ultimately you can always bring it back to the L1 and claim your assets. It might take some time, you might be liquidated, whatever, but if you don't have fraud proofs on an L2, you're kind of hosed in that scenario. Like, that's a very big jump. Where are you guys in that continuum? Like, in a scenario where you might want to contest that, you might want to challenge that, you get slashed, whatever, is there a mechanism to dispute that, to ultimately settle? Like, I don't know if the question makes sense.
Yeah. So within the network, we have a vote program where each node votes on the validity of the transaction that's been settled. And once that transaction gets the majority of the votes, that's settled. And this program handles like slashing and which nodes got it right, which ones didn't, and what's considered malicious or not.
Got it. And that's there's a, I guess, a prover, and then there's like a observers that are just voting on it. And then once that's done, it's done, right? There's no like period where you can contest that. I guess once it's settled, it's settled. You're confined by that block time.
Yeah, then, we are committing the settlement to Bitcoin, so you really can't change it. Once it goes to Bitcoin, it's fine. Yeah,
but Santi, you brought up a great point that a lot of these L2s are just very like thinly veiled multisigs at the end of the day. Right. That as a user, you have absolutely no recourse if anything goes awry, and you know, that's what we're strongly counter-positioning against. Like, we feel that even though that, you know, there is a multi-sig in the loop of what Arch entails, you know, there's no bridging of those assets. Everything is proven to be correct, and the execution actually did happen in a secure way. And that's the main difference. And you can draw assumptions to like program-derived addresses on Solana or smart contract controlled wallets on Ethereum. We're doing something similar with multisigs, but at the end of the day, there's no bridging that happens of this asset, and the verifier network is what keeps those wallets and those smart contracts and these applications in check.
Right. Yeah. How much disclosure will there be? I assume pretty transparent on who is part of this network. Yeah, or would you, for security reasons, not really make it as public?
I will make it public, like who is participating in the network at like every stage on the way that we make everything decentralized and permissionless.
Yeah, everyone wants to chase yield. It is important. Anyone that tells you it's not is kidding themselves. We are rational economic people. What is the type of like inflation curve? What is a fee like incentive for these people? Maybe we just touch a little bit on tokenomics and how that plays in and how that's important to kind of bootstrap.
Yes. So we do operate sort of on a gas model similar to that of Ethereum, where in addition to the Bitcoin fees that you'll pay, which is going to be standard and required to post the transactions back to Bitcoin, can't get around that. But we mark up the network resources of the VM, which is extremely small compared to what the Bitcoin fees turn out to be, and we share those fees with the validator network who are running the nodes.
Got it. But initially, is it like most networks, you have like a high inflation curve and then it kind of decays over time? There's like a
In terms of like the ROI for these, for the people putting up stake?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that running a node is going to be one of the, you know, the best opportunities in our ecosystem. And initially, the, you know, the APY or ROI of providing stake is going to be an enormous opportunity for those who want to get involved early. So yeah, I would say that that's definitely going to be an attractive scenario for people who want to participate and support the network. And then, of course, as time goes on and the token rewards start to plateau a bit, you know, then it's going, we'll be fully decentralized by then and permissionless to the point where we no longer need to prove the efficacy or the attractiveness or allure of wanting to supply stake to secure the network.
Right. Two questions as we just kind of sort of round it out. One is how easy is it for developers to build? What's kind of the tooling, you know, the developer experience? So that's
we put a huge emphasis on onboarding developers and their experience to make it as elegant as possible. We're completely built in Rust, so anybody who knows Rust, they can come in and deploy in our testnet. And maybe just a little bit of Bitcoin knowledge, but you don't need to know any Bitcoin script or any additional programming language in order to deploy, which is, you know, easy from the standpoint of onboarding developers and projects. We're working with several projects coming from the Solana ecosystem who are obviously already built mainly in Rust. So porting over their smart contracts that they've already worked on or built or their frameworks is an easy lift for them.
Right.
It's also very similar to the Solana programming model since we're still doing parallelization. So for Solana developers, it's really easy. You don't even need to change the way you think. But it's for other people, it's still easy. You just trust some high-level Bitcoin knowledge.
Yeah, you should go talk to the Tensor guys, you know, or some of the apps in Solana, because Magic Eden is kind of eating a lunch of Bitcoin. I would assume that they might be interested in deploying an Arc.
Might be talking to them.
I can't confirm or deny, but you know, if I was Tensor, I'd definitely be looking at the Ordinals ecosystem for coming into to play around there.
Very nice. Maybe let's just talk about the roadmap from here. I know you guys are coming out of stealth. What are the next 6-12 months look like? And I mean, don't kill me for asking the questions, because I know developers hate when they get deadline set on the development roadmap.
Yeah, so I mentioned our DevNet has been live now in private beta for about 6 weeks. So we've been working with about 20 different projects who are all currently building and integrating into our stack or our solution into their stack, I should say. So we're in the coming weeks, we'll definitely be launching our public DevNet, which will be inviting anybody who wants to come in and build into Bitcoin on top of Arch to come in and deploy dApps or protocols. Shortly after that, we'll roll out our incentivized testnet. So the builders who have been building on Arch can actually deploy their applications in a way where now the consumers can participate in those testnet environments and come see what smart contracts on Bitcoin and smart applications on Bitcoin ultimately look like. And then shortly followed after that, it's mainnet release. So we're looking at May as nice. our May. Timeline. Yeah.
Wow. Well, this is fascinating discussion, guys. No, this is good. What anything else we haven't discussed that you guys want to touch on while we're here?
No, I think that we literally just hit on it. I think that stay tuned for the rollout of the public testnet, because that's going to be, you know, an exciting moment for Arch and the Bitcoin ecosystem as a whole, where we can see now what programmability actually looks like. Because for most people who, you know, are knowledgeable in the space, but maybe not knowledgeable with respect to Arch, they're kind of convinced already that programmability is out of bounds for native Bitcoin. So we're here today to share that that's not the case. It's coming, and pretty soon you'll be able to participate in what that programmability is ultimately going to look like, and maybe farm some points on Arch, farm some points on these applications who are also going to be launching their own incentivized programs, and it's going to be an exciting time. DeFi Summer 2.0.
That's awesome. Well, really cool, guys. Thanks for coming on and sharing the story. What's the best resource for developers and users and other folks in the community to learn about, dive into documentation, but also maybe your hiring and other stuff?
First, I'd say follow our Twitter. That's where we're going to be extremely active on comms in the coming weeks. Arch Network with no vowels on the network, NTWRK. And you can go to our website, archnetwork.xyz or arch.network. And you can apply if you're a developer to be given access to our DevNet, as well as dive deep into the docs, which there are links as well there on the website.
Really cool. Folks, well, it's great. We always like to bring on teams that are coming out of stealth. I think we've had a pretty good track record, Yano. So thanks for coming on and sharing the story. Very exciting. Yano and I both had Bitcoin L2s or Bitcoin, more programmability and Bitcoin utility as a key theme. We still certainly believe that. So it's great to hear the story and how you guys are positioning and differentiating. So best of luck, and we'll certainly be following your progress. And maybe we can have you guys on later on this year as you roll out mainnet and start seeing more traction.
Absolutely. You guys had Kathy Wood on before, right?
We did last week.
I think her base case for Bitcoin is starting to sound less and less kooky as DeFi summer rolls out. So maybe we could do a show with her sometime when this whole thing plays out.
Yeah, I love it. Cool. Thank you, Matt. Thank you. This is great, guys.
Thanks, Jens. Cheers.
Hey everyone, Jason here. Thank you so much for watching today's episode. Wanted to take a quick second to thank today's title sponsor, Arbitrum. We know you are tired of on-chain experiences that have unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds, and that's why we partnered with Arbitrum. You can experience frictionless trades, lightning speed, and lag-free transactions, all for pennies per transaction. Explore Arbitrum's expanding ecosystem at portal.arbitrum.io. That's portal.arbitrum.io. See you for the next episode.